regional and urban Australians are more similar than they are different in terms of their climate attitudes. You know, when we ask about Australia's economic recovery, we see that 64% of urban Australians would like it to be powered by renewable energy, and 61% of regional Australians would as well.
One for mum, one for dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. Don't
hurt. Treasure.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we're going to be talking about the Australia Institute's annual Climate of the Nation report. It's the country's longest running survey of community attitudes towards climate change. And this year, Climate of the Nation explored attitudes towards fossil fuel subsidies, the appetite that Australian households have for electrifying everything in our homes, as well as support for a net zero emissions target and bigger 2030 targets, as we're just weeks out now from the Glasgow COP26 climate summit.
More on that new report from the Australia Institute showing that concern for climate change is at an all-time high.
Three quarters of Aussies, the highest proportion yet, are concerned about climate change.
A national survey confirming climate change is far from a fringe issue.
The Prime Minister has flagged he'll update Australia's climate targets before COP26.
It's going to be a big week in Canberra as the Prime Minister tries to lock in a plan for net zero emissions with the National Party.
Barnaby Joyce concedes Scott Morrison could go to Glasgow promising net zero emissions without the backing of the coalition.
But the clock's ticking, as you know. The Prime Minister jets off to Glasgow effectively at the end of next week. He cannot go there, can he, feasibly, without having Australia sign up to a 2050 target?
Right now, it's a no.
The global economy is changing as the world responds to climate change.
Members on my left.
It's not about anybody being held to ransom or grandstanding.
This could get a little bit ugly.
We need targets for 2030, not 2050. And today I'm delighted to introduce Richie Merzian, the Climate and Energy Program Director at the Australia Institute, and Audrey Quick, Climate and Energy Researcher at the Institute and author of Climate of the Nation. G'day, Richie and Audrey. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Hi, Ebony.
Richie, before we get stuck into Climate of the Nation, obviously anyone who follows climate politics was waiting on tenterhooks to see the outcome from the Nationals' joint party room discussion on the weekend. Has the Nationals' party realised yet that they've been in government for the past 7 years? Are we still waiting on an outcome there?
They are the proverbial uni student that had 6 months for their coursework, and then the night before is like, crap, crap, crap. There's no way I could possibly finish it. This is so unfair.
The cryptic art of trying to come to a consensus position, and you don't do that at 4 hours on a Sunday night.
And now we're still waiting. We're doing what Australia does best, which is waiting to do very little on climate change.
Yeah, just delaying, putting it off till some future moment.
We're less than 2 weeks from COP26, the largest climate meeting since the Paris Agreement. This is the same government that's been in power since the Paris Agreement, and all it wants to do right now is what it took to the Paris Agreement. So it's all quite disappointing. Hopefully things move, but net zero by 2050 would be the bare minimum, if that.
Yeah. Thanks for that disappointing update, Richie, and we'll keep everyone posted. But Audrey, to talk about the actual Climate of the Nation report and its findings, obviously it's a huge survey. We do it every year. It's been running for many, many years. What are some of the key findings from this year's report?
Yeah, so you're right. It is a really important report, and it's predominantly a tracking poll, so it allows us to see how attitudes to climate change have changed over time. But then we also put in new questions each year so we can see these really relevant questions. And look, this year, I think one of the big things that we see is just the concern about climate change. 75% of Australians are concerned about climate change, and that has just steadily been increasing year upon year. But then within that, we also see that the percentage who say they're very concerned has also been increasing. So that concern's intensifying. Look, there's lots of headline figures from this year's report. We see that Australians really back policies to decarbonise and to address climate change. So 82% of Australians support a phase out of coal-fired power stations. 79% of Australians rank solar in their top three preferred energy sources. 74% of Australians support state governments putting in place incentives for more renewable energy. I could go on and on, but I'm sure we'll, you know, tap into some of those findings a little bit further on as well.
Yeah, so overall, quite strong concern about climate and a lot of strong support, overwhelming support for policies to decarbonise.
Absolutely.
There's been a bunch of polls. We saw one this week, the Climate of the Nation survey, which is, you know, one of maybe the biggest annual climate poll that we have in Australia, and it said 75% of Australians, a new high, are concerned about climate change, and similar sorts of numbers want to see action.
The poison that's been injected into the body politic as a consequence of the last 10 years is going to take time to leach from the body. You can't just sort of snap your fingers and recover from that. It's going to take some time. And the problem we've had, you know, you referred earlier, Adam, to the succession of polls, including Climate of the Nation, which is the most authoritative long-term climate poll in the country, showing these large, you know, super majorities, basically, in favour, people concerned, people in favour of action. But the thing is, there is still, say, 30% of the country that is not in favour of action, does not accept the science, does not, you know, just thinks this is all bullshit.
Audrey, I want to dig in, as you've said, to some of those results. And the first one I wanted to ask about was the section around electrifying everything. That is this idea that we've got to move off, you know, gas-fired stoves, gas-fired heating in our homes, convert to, you know, solar hot water, all of those types of things, just electrifying everything that we possibly can because we know we can get to 100% renewables in the electricity sector. What did Climate of the Nation show about the appetite for households making that kind of conversion?
Yeah, so what we see in results is just that there is this strong willingness to electrify your homes and to electrify your vehicles. So we break this down sort of into three sections. We ask respondents whether they would consider switching to electric stoves, electric ovens, hot water and home heating. And we see that an overwhelming majority absolutely would consider these things. There is a small portion that would need financial incentives to do so. But overall, we just see this really strong willingness. People are prepared to do this. They're prepared to electrify. And then we also see the same for electric vehicles as well. So a majority of respondents would consider purchasing an electric vehicle next time they're in the market to buy a car. But with EVs, we see that those financial incentives are a bit more of a driver here. So they are really important when it comes to EVs. We also dug down a little bit deeper into EV policy particularly. And I think this is, you know, particularly relevant in Australia today because we know that we don't have an EV policy. We drastically need one. We've been promised one year upon year. And finally, what we've got is this future fuels discussion paper instead of an EV policy, which looks at, you know, hydrogen-fueled vehicles. It looks at biofueled vehicles. And so it kind of mashes all these things into one policy. So we really wanted to tap into which particular electric vehicle policies Australians really support. So we polled 9 different policies and we just see overwhelming support for every single one of them. So the ones that are really popular right up the top are ones that give government support to domestic manufacturing of these vehicles, batteries and their component parts. We see really strong support for building of fast charging stations, for electrifying our state bus fleets. All of these have around 3/4 of the public supporting them.
Yeah.
And then down the bottom, we see that there's still 64%, so still a big majority of people would actually support requiring all new car sales in Australia to be zero emissions vehicles by 2035. So some pretty strong results.
Yeah, and certainly that's the way things seem to be going internationally. But Richie, my last tank of petrol lasted me about 3 months because of lockdown. But I got a bit of a rude shock when I went to fill up the other week. It cost me $15 more to fill up my car than it did the last time I filled it up. So obviously we've got a strong appetite for switching over to electric vehicles if the incentives are right there. But when it comes to electrifying everything in the home, there's a lot of savings to be made there as well.
That's right. So the work that Saul Griffith and Rewiring Australia produced and we launched on our webinar series shows that households in Australia could save somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 per year by actually making the switch in appliances, getting off gas for your stove, for your heating, for your hot water, electrifying your vehicles, popping panels on there, putting in even a household battery. Massive savings will accrue to you because it's so much cheaper to run these appliances. They're so much more efficient in terms of their energy use. And when you break it down, electricity and vehicle energy and gas use at home, that's about 33% of Australia's national emissions right there. So by electrifying that with clean energy, it's just a huge chunk that we can green up immediately. And people want to. They want to take that action. Audrey's stats show that 7 out of 10 want to do this. Of those, around a third would like incentives, and that's the role governments can play. And when we had the Victorian Energy Minister on board, she was talking about their gas substitution plan. They're looking at rolling this out. We know Matt Keane, the New South Wales Energy Minister, is looking at the same kind of approach too. So it's popular across the political spectrum as well.
Ebony, when you talk about those household savings, I think this is one of those reasons that we see such broad support for these policies, because we also ask in Climate of the Nation what people perceive as the biggest benefits of electrification. And there are so many different benefits and they rank differently according to your demographics. So it's not just that these things are going to reduce greenhouse gases, it's that there's those household savings, it's that there's the fuel security implications of electric vehicles, all of these other benefits that might appeal to people who maybe the climate benefits aren't the number one thing that they see.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
We need to electrify our castles and save us some cash.
Bye-bye, big bills. Buongiorno, fancy French wine. Electrify your rooftops, utes, and the way you cook your spag bowl. It can even save our future. So do it for the money and do it for our kids. Electrify your castle. Electrify everything.
And it did make me think about here in the glorious People's Republic of the ACT, you know, I've just moved into a new apartment here. There's no gas connections in this whole apartment building. Like, and that was, you know, a feature, part of the reason why I bought it.
That's great. And it's unique. It's unique in Australia. There's still obligations on developers to put in gas in a number of states. Hopefully we'll see more of this de-linked as we electrify.
Yeah. Audrey, I wanted to ask next about fossil fuel subsidies. Obviously, Australia's supposed to be in the middle of a gas-fired recovery. Not that we really are. We're certainly giving money hand over fist to gas and coal companies, though. You looked at Australia's attitudes towards subsidies for fossil fuels. What did the results show this year?
Yeah, well, firstly, you mentioned the gas-fired recovery there, and we do poll that particular question. So we ask respondents whether they would prefer Australia's recovery from COVID, that economic recovery, to be primarily powered by investment in gas or renewables. And we see that only 12% pick gas there, so really unpopular, whereas around 63% pick renewables. So firstly, we see that the gas-fired recovery is just not popular at all, and we saw the same thing last year. It's, yeah, a big dud. Big fat dud. But then we drilled more deeper into fossil fuel subsidies. So firstly, what we saw was that there really just wasn't much knowledge of fossil fuel subsidies. Only 37% of Australians were able to actually correctly answer that state, territory and federal governments provide these subsidies to the fossil fuel industry.
So heaps of people thought that they just don't do this kind of thing. Governments don't give out subsidies.
Yeah, so some people thought that maybe it was coming just from the federal government. Some people thought it was coming just from states. A lot of people just said don't know. So it's just around that slightly over a third that can correctly state it's coming from all of these levels of government. But then we informed them about the amount. So I think you mentioned there it's around 10.3 billion in the 2020 to 21 budget year that was provided to these industries or used to subsidise fossil fuels in some way. So when respondents were informed of this, we saw that twice as many opposed that amount than supported it. So again, really not popular. 57% of Australians oppose that amount of fossil fuel subsidies.
And the more they know about it, the more they oppose it. Richie, obviously there's a huge number of people there that just aren't aware of the level or the scope of fossil fuel subsidies. But another thing that shocked me was basically how huge Australians think the gas and coal industry are, how many people it's supposed to employ, how much it contributes to GDP. And it's just completely disconnected from reality. I guess it shows how good their lobbyists and PR firms are. But did that shock you?
Decades and decades of very strong marketing and state capture have paid off. It's a good investment fossil fuel industry. I mean, yeah, it has, because the numbers seem to have been getting worse between last year and this year in terms of the amount of people who thought the gas industry employed, what was it like, something like 46 times as many people? And that the income from the gas industry was 55 times what they actually bring in. It's just off the charts in terms of how massive the disinformation campaign has been and the impact it's been. And you can kind of understand why when there was another key question that we asked and the results from that, which is we asked whether people thought there were too many conflicting opinions out in the public on climate change to know what to do or where to go. And 48% of Australians, almost half of the population, agreed. They said it's just too hard to know what's what. And if you've been told for decades that coal and gas are essential for our national income and for our national employment, then that's probably going to sink in.
An Australia Institute report says Australia has already spent $10.3 billion of taxpayers' money on fossil fuel subsidies.
The Australia Institute shows that over $10 billion in government subsidies were given to coal, oil and gas companies and other major users of fossil fuels.
I just want to stick with that gap between reality and perceptions for a minute, because I think it is worth underlying. When it comes to gas and oil industry and the share of employment, most Australians think that it employs about 1 in 10 workers in the workforce, when in reality it's 0.2% of the workforce, so way less than half of one person in 100 is the reality. So there's just a huge gap there, and they think it provides about 11% of GDP, and it's only around 3% of GDP. I mean, just the gap is so enormous.
Absolutely. And when you look at that by demographics as well, it doesn't really change much. It's everyone that overestimates the role of the coal and gas industry, both in terms of employment and in terms of their contribution to GDP. It's all age groups, it's all genders, no matter which state you're from, no matter how much you care about climate change as well. So even if you're someone that is backing all of these other policies on climate change and has said that you're quite concerned about climate change, you're still quite likely to overestimate the value of these industries.
Yeah. Well, it's horrifying, but huge congratulations to the gas and coal industry on their successful lobbying effort. That probably makes them the most effective lobbyists and PR people in the country, I'd imagine. Audrey, the next thing I wanted to ask about was 2030 targets and net zero by 2050. Obviously, that's where the Australian debate is right at the moment. We've seen a lot of other countries commit to much more ambitious targets. What are Australians think about 2030 and net zero by 2050?
Yeah, so we ask a question about setting targets. We ask, should Australia set targets and implement domestic action to help limit global warming to 1.5 to 2 degrees and achieve net zero emissions? And we see that 69% of Australians agree. And just to be clear, that's not necessarily net zero emissions by 2050. That could be much sooner. And we see that the vast majority of Australians support that, and only 10% disagree with that one. And then we also see that over 50% of Australians want a more ambitious 2030 target.
Richie, a lot of other countries have raised their ambition. The Prime Minister appears to have ruled out lifting our 2030 target. Is that where we're at the moment?
Yeah, basically Australia's already failed. The whole purpose of Glasgow is to increase your short-term target, to update it from what you announced prior to Paris, because we're failing. We're failing to collectively limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. So the US has pretty much doubled. They will halve their emissions by 2030. The UK drop it by 68%, the EU 55%, Japan 46%. All our allies, all the G7 countries have upped their short-term impact. And then without even landing on a broad plan, the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister have ruled out increasing that target. What they might come forward with is an increase in the projection. So basically saying we will meet and beat our target, but we won't actually be accountable to doing so, just in case something changes. But a projection or an expectation is not a target.
Yeah, and it seems odd that they'll be trumpeting this idea that we can beat it, but they're not really willing to back it with a subsequent lift in the actual target.
Yeah, it's like your mate that says, oh yeah, I could totally lift those weights. Yeah, I totally could. I'm not going to, but I could.
Easily. I don't want to show off.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't want to show off.
This government is trying to cheat on climate action again. Their plan for net zero emissions by 2050 is a fraud if gas and coal are allowed to expand. The government is plotting to double coal exports, open vast new gas fields, and prop up coal-generated power. Unless they halt dirty fossil fuels and power our nation with clean electricity, their net zero plan is worthless. Demand the government phase out gas and coal.
Net zero by 2050. The Australia Institute is running a big ad campaign at the moment because basically we are expecting that the Morrison government is going to make some kind of commitment around net zero by 2050. But at the same time, they're expanding the gas and coal industry. Are those two things compatible?
No, you can't have your cake and eat it too. Right, net zero by 2050 is a fraud if fossil fuels flourish. And right now the Australian government is pursuing three massive new gas basins in Queensland, in the NT, in WA, that in aggregate, the full carbon footprint is about two-thirds Australia's national emissions. I mean, there's 20 new coal mine proposals in New South Wales alone. Like, you can't have it both ways. Fossil fuel expansion and net zero do not go together, and that's clearly what the International Energy Agency explained when it put forward a pathway that actually limits global warming to 1.5 degrees. And we asked punters, should we adopt this pathway? And 60% of Australians came back and said, yes, we want a pathway that doesn't have new coal, oil or gas. And even if you split that up between regional Australians and those in the capital cities, 58% in the region say that yes, we should have a halt on new coal, oil and gas, because that's what a legitimate, credible pathway to net zero by 2050 requires.
Mm. And it strikes me, as much as we're dragging on the Nationals here, and they certainly deserve it, I mean, at the state level, Matt Keane has been incredibly positive and open about the opportunities that there are for regional Australians by making this transition, but we just don't see any of that reflected federally.
No, it's kind of otherworldly. Yes, New South Wales will have emissions by 2030. That's what they project. And then they go that step further and they actually lock it into a target. And if you ask, Matt Keane why, he'll basically say it's because it's clearly in our state interest. And the ones who will benefit are those in the regions, because the 30 odd billion dollars that will flow into the New South Wales economy to invest in that new development will go into the regional areas. That's where you're going to build these huge renewable energy zones. It's not in the cities.
Mm.
And it seems like the New South Wales Nationals understand that.
Of course, rural and regional Australia will pay the price for unchecked climate change through droughts, a falling farm productivity, falling farm profits, natural disasters, and is the beneficiary of proper policy on climate change. These are the regions, Fran, that will continue to power Australia under a renewable economy and export renewable energy.
That's the climate. See, this will have really little effect in urban air, in the capital cities. You guys really don't get affected by the decisions. We do. And to be quite frank, your emissions keep going up and ours go down. That's how you're meeting your targets. But if there was a package that was really created massive changes in how people live their lives in Sydney, this would never see daylight.
Oh, look, just to reiterate that urban-regional divide, we just don't see it in the results. We keep hearing about it in the media, but then when you split our data into those two cohorts, you just see that regional and urban Australians are more similar than they are different in terms of their climate attitudes. You know, when we ask about Australia's economic recovery, we see that 64% of urban Australians would like it to be powered by renewable energy and 61% of regional Australians would as well. We see that regional Australians are actually more likely to oppose those fossil fuel subsidies we were talking about. So really there isn't this divide that we keep hearing about.
Mm. One other thing that I just thought was an amazing statistic is that in Queensland, which is apparently where the blockage is, since New South Wales Nationals obviously understand what, you know, halving emissions by this decade looks like, in Queensland, when asked whether coal mining has a strong economic future, that result dropped by 8 percentage points between last year when 45% of Queenslanders believed it was strong to this year with only 37%.
Mm.
So you're even seeing that those haul downs are starting to lose their confidence in what's going to happen. And that's going to happen because it's going to happen regardless, right? Most coal in Australia is exported. Those export markets all have net zero by 2050 or 2060. So change is coming. And even those who are holding out or lied to by, you know, some of their political masters are now realising that things are going to change.
I think that Glasgow COP26 is a turning point for the world, and it's the moment when we have to grow up and take our responsibilities. I think
the drive to net zero must become the new normal for everyone, everywhere.
The people in power cannot claim that they are trying, because they are clearly not, as they continue opening up brand new coal mines, oil fields and pipelines. If this is what they consider to be climate action, then we don't want it.
Yeah, Richie, I'll finish with you. You're hoping to head off to Glasgow next week. What are we expecting Australia's reception to be when you get there?
Yeah, that's right. Making the rare journey outside of our shores.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it is pretty exciting and daunting. But I'm expecting basically to see a huge chorus of support for stronger immediate climate action. The UK are rallying countries to put forward new targets. Even in the last week, we've seen big fossil fuel exporters like the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, put forward a target. We're hearing India might increase its 2030 target as well. Turkey is basically rejoining it. It's a G20 economy and looking at increasing its efforts. So you're seeing a lot more action, even from holdouts or those who don't usually step up at these climate meetings. And the UK has also put coal front and center. The UK COP president has said they want to see coal power consigned to history. And this is the birthplace of coal. And they've gone 40% coal power to 2% in the last 10 years. They're going to get to zero, and they want others to follow. And I think that's going to be quite hard for the man who took a lump of coal into Parliament to deal with.
Well, the best of luck, Richie. We can't wait to get your updates, but we certainly hope that it's safe travels. I'm sure it won't be too hard getting there, but hopefully today's announcements from the various premiers have smoothed the way back into the country at the very least. And thanks, Audrey, for writing such a great report. People can find that on the Australia Institute's website. Thanks, Richie and Audrey. That's all we've got time for today. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 19th of October, 2021, and things may have changed since recording. I'd like to thank Guardian Australia for allowing us to use a clip from the latest episode of their podcast, Australian Politics, with Catherine Murphy, and you can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research, including the Climate of the Nation report. And you can also visit our website if you'd like to donate to help get our net zero fraud ad on the telly and in the papers. That's australiainstitute.org.au. And you can find us on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian. Audrey Quick is at Audrey Quick. That's Quick with an E on the end. Our producer is Jennifer Macy. You can find her at Jennifer Macy. And our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Stay safe out there, and thanks for listening.